Welcome to the New Life Podcast, a ministry of New Life Presbyterian Church in Ithaca, New York. Today we have this week's sermon preached by Tim LaCroix, our senior pastor. Join us for worship each week at 10 o'clock at 950 Danby Road, Ithaca, New York. You can also visit us on our website, www.newlifeithaca.org. Now here's this week's sermon.
A reading of the Holy Gospel of St. Matthew, chapter 5, verses 21 to 26, and verses 38 to 48. Please stand if you are able. You have heard it said, you have heard that it was said to those of old, "You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment." But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. And whoever says, "You fool," will be liable to the hell of fire. So, if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you are going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge, and the judge to the guard, and you be put in prison. Truly, I say to you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny. You have heard it was said, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who begs from you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you. You have heard that it was said, "You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy." But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet only your brothers, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? Therefore, you must be perfect, as your heavenly Father is perfect. The Gospel of the Lord.
Glory to you, O Lord.
The state of our public discourse these days is not very good. What accounts for rhetoric these days is to find the best insulting nickname or the best insult. If we analyze the rhetoric, mostly political rhetoric, but public ways of speaking to one another, we'll see, I think, three things. The first step is to find an insulting nickname for someone. The second step then is to spew all sorts of lies, mistruths, half-truths as your message. And then the third step is when anyone calls you on those mistruths or even asks for clarification or even just asks to have a dialogue, you attack them and you call them names. That is what I see over and over in my social media feed. It's what I see over and over from our politicians in debates and in speeches. This is the level of what we have today. The ethics of this rhetoric are grounded in the fact that if my enemy is wrong and my enemy is dangerous, then I can do whatever it takes in order to take my enemy down. I can lie, I can attack, I can do things that otherwise I might consider not worth doing or good to do because the result is the danger is so great and the result is so needful. This ethics is no different from the bankrupt moral ethics of consequentialism, which says the end justifies the means. We also see, if you are involved in social media, another pernicious form of engaging in public discourse, that of the anonymous account. If you don't know what anonymous accounts are, it is when someone does not reveal their real name. Usually it is some sort of name that will tell you a little something about their ideology or their viewpoint, and it does not reveal their true picture. It's some picture that will likewise do the same. And the reason why most, there are legitimate reasons to be anonymous, but the reason why most folks have anonymous accounts is so they can say whatever they want with impunity. The sad thing is, friends, that these ethics and this level of discourse and these anonymous accounts are not just found in the secular world, they are found in and amongst the church. I see that the rhetoric of our churches also results to the same kind of bankrupt moral rhetoric that we see out in the world. If my theological opponent is dangerous enough, that means I can attack that person. I can go after that person. I can play fast and loose with the truth. Because that person is a danger. That person is a threat. We even see these anonymous accounts amongst Christians, even pastors, even PCA pastors who have anonymous accounts so they can say whatever they want with impunity. Brothers and sisters, this is not the way of Christ. Either in our discourse or in the discourse, the public discourse, or in the discourse of the church, this is not the way that Jesus teaches us. Jesus says, do not retaliate. Jesus says, love your enemies. There is not an exception in the gospel, in the teaching of Jesus, to not love your enemy and not do what's best for your enemy. If he is a threat, of course, deemed by myself, I am the judge of who is a threat that is big enough to attack. There's no exception. Some people will make exceptions to say, oh, it is loving if I point out my brother's error. That's casuistry. Casuistry is a way to get around the plain teachings of God's law through clever tricks of thinking or loosening the requirements. This is casuistry, is what we see in the scribes and Pharisees. The very thing that we find Jesus going after here in chapter 5 of the Sermon on the Mount is the very thing that we'll see people engage in to make their behavior defensible. Now, you may say, Pastor, I'm not involved online and I don't engage personally in this kind of rhetoric. And I say, you know, probably that's true for most of us, if not all of us. So why should I talk about it? Well, for one, I think as a pastor, you need to hear me speak out against the harmful things that the church is doing, especially the leaders of the church. You've heard me say before that there are recent studies, religious demographers have discovered and articulated that the largest religious group in the country are called the religious nones, those who would say no religion or none when they were asked what their faith is. And when sociologists of religion have studied this demographic of people, largely who have deconstructed, which means deconstructed their faith, walked away from the faith of their childhood or early adulthood, we find that one of the reasons why people have deconstructed is because the church is not following the way of Christ. Some of you know that some of my dearest friends in the world are YouTube, I'll call them stars, Rhett and Link. They have millions of followers. If you know about them, they're quite a big deal. But if you don't, there wouldn't be. But anyway, we're close friends. We were in college roommates together. We're in each other's weddings. We still keep up. We're still very close. In fact, we saw Rhett while we were away in North Carolina, and had dinner with him and his wife. They have a podcast called Ear Biscuits. It's a funny, ridiculous name, but that's what it is, Ear Biscuits. And on that podcast a few years ago, they gave their deconstruction story on the podcast. The Rhett and Link used to be, formerly were professing Christians, evangelical Christians, even missionaries. They worked for a campus organization that some of you have heard of, CRU, Campus Crusade, we called it, back in the day. But on their podcast, they came out with their deconstructed. They said they no longer believed in Jesus. They no longer believed in God. One of the things that I remember Rhett saying, and it's haunting. It haunts me now. And he was saying, sort of speaking for all those of his generation and younger that have deconstructed, saying, "You taught us the way of Jesus, but we do not find that you," speaking of parents, "you and the rest of the church are following the Jesus that you taught us to follow." That's an indictment. That sticks. So friends, I think these things are relevant as we look to this message of Christ. As we have talked about, as I mentioned in previous sermons, that the ethics of Christ are considered by many people to be the most highly elevated and purest ethics that have ever been given. And the passage that we read today is a part of that, specifically non-retaliation and love for enemies. If you look on page 3 of your bulletin, there's a quote there. It's from Alfred Plummer, and I'll summarize. "To return evil for good is diabolical. To return good for good and evil for evil is human. But to return good for evil is divine." Many people, from Mahatma Gandhi to Martin Luther King Jr., have recognized that the ethics that Christ is giving here, this non-retaliation, this turn the other cheek, the love of enemies, is revolutionary, it is radical, and it has the potential to change the world. When people speak of the moral philosophy of Christ being one of the greatest moral philosophies ever articulated, this is what they're referring to, this sort of ethic that he is teaching and preaching that we read today. I think it is very relevant. I think it is relevant for our time because we see, as I just said, that our culture is behaving in the way, against the way that Christ is showing and has showed up even in the church. So today we're going to have three sections that I'm going to talk through. And as we look through the first, the second, and the third, there's a progression. And sort of moves upward in the height of the ethic articulated and the difficulty. So we're going to move from good to better to best. Good, better, best. This is the fifth sermon in our series of Sermon on the Mount. I know we haven't been here for a while, so let me just give you a little bit of something to orient us. One of the things that Jesus is doing in the Sermon on the Mount, well, he's doing two main things, and they may seem contradictory, but I want to try to tie it together. The first thing that Jesus is doing is he's going after the fast and loose casuistry of the scribes and Pharisees, who have basically made the law achievable by their explanations. We see it very clearly in the first verse that we read. "You have heard it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder.'" This is a direct quotation of the sixth commandment. Those of old were those who heard it directly from God at Mount Sinai. "You have heard it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder.'" Now, what does this have to do with the scribes and Pharisees and how they have loosened the requirements of the law? We can glean from context and also rabbinic writings of the time that what the scribes and Pharisees were teaching is that the way you keep the sixth commandment is to avoid murder. As long as you avoid murdering someone, you've kept the sixth commandment. So almost all of us, in fact, I would hope all of us could say that we have kept the sixth commandment because we have not murdered anyone. But Jesus says, no, there is much more to the sixth commandment than simply avoiding murder. He says, if you are angry with your brother, you are liable to judgment. In this statement here, in this first passage, verse 22, is an escalating, ramping up of what he's saying is the three examples. Not only did the scribes and Pharisees teach that you could avoid breaking the sixth commandment and keeping the sixth commandment by avoiding murder. They also said, as you see, it says, do not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. That phrase does not appear in the Bible. That is a part of the Pharisaical teaching. What that means is they believed that they would only be liable to civil judgment. They actually believed that if they murdered, they could be executed, but they wouldn't have spiritual consequences in the afterlife. So not only are they lessening the requirements of the commandment, they're removing its punishment, except for civil punishment, which was death for death. But Jesus says, no, no, no. Not only is the requirement of the sixth commandment far greater, but the punishment is far worse. So he says, anyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to the secular authorities. But whoever insults his brother, and the word there is raka, which is insulting intelligence, basically. Whoever insults his brother's intelligence, calls him an idiot, will be liable to the ecclesiastical council. So church judgment. And whoever says, you fool, the word is more or moron, insulting a person's heart or character, you scoundrel, whoever says that will be liable to the hell of fire. Now, it's not the case that if I'm angry, I'm not liable to the hell of fire. That's not what he's saying. He's ramping up the judgments. He's saying whenever we break any of the least of these commandments, we are liable for them all. We cannot get away with murder. Keeping the sixth commandment is not just avoiding murder. It is not being angry with our brother. It is not calling people insulting their intelligence or their character. Because if you do that, you've murdered them. And you're liable for eternity. That's a good keeping of the commandment. Here's a better keeping of the sixth commandment. We move ahead to verse 38. In verse 38, the requirements are ramped up just a bit. It says, not only should you avoid murder and avoid anger, but you should also not retaliate when someone does something wrong to you. He says, you have heard it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. This is a direct quotation from three different places in the Old Testament law. Verse 38. It's from Exodus 21:24, Leviticus 24:20, and Deuteronomy 19:21. And those three occasions are in the context of civil punishments. What's going on here is two things. This is called the lex talionis, or the law of retaliation. It was not only the Israelites who had such a law, it's famous because the Babylonians also had it. There's two reasons to have this lex talionis. The first is to make sure that retribution is proportionate. It's not the case that if someone takes one eye, I can take two eyes. Or if someone takes a tooth, I can take all their teeth. No, it's one eye for one eye, one tooth for one tooth, one life for one life. It's proportional. But the other purpose of the lex talionis is to make sure there is judgment. To make sure that people don't get away with when they harm others. In Jesus' day, they were no longer knocking out teeth and taking out eyes. In Jesus' time, they had replaced that with a financial restitution that was paid. But Jesus is taking this in its popular application that if as an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth means I can get back at my enemies. And Jesus says, no, that is not given for individuals. Individuals have not been given the authority to carry out criminal penalty. He says, I say to you, do not even resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, give him your cloak as well. That effectively leaves the person without any clothes because most of the dress was a tunic and a cloak, two-piece garment. And the cloak also was what a poor man or poor woman would use as a blanket as they slept, if they didn't have anything else. And then it says, if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. The context for this is a soldier, a Roman soldier, forcing someone to carry something for him. He says, if a Roman soldier comes and asks you to carry something 1 mile, do it 2 miles. And so Jesus says we shall not retaliate, as we read in Romans chapter 12, that we should leave it to God. Brothers, do not avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. And so this does not mean that evil is not to be held to account. It simply means it's not for us to do it. As I told the children in the children's sermon, it also does not mean that you ought to allow someone to continually abuse you. It is appropriate to let the authorities know what is going on. If you're a kid, that means your parents. If you are an adult, that means, well, church authorities and civil authorities. Jesus is not saying don't protect yourself. He's not saying don't have boundaries. He's saying don't retaliate. Don't punch back. And indeed, as I told the kids, if we are turning the cheek, we are facing someone eye to eye. We are confronting that person with the evil that they are doing to us. And of course, the reason why we can turn the other cheek is because Jesus turned his cheeks to those who tormented him and turned his back to the smiters. That's better. It's good to avoid murder. It's better not to retaliate. Thirdly, it's best to love your enemies. That one is hard. As St. Augustine said, many have learned how to offer the other cheek, but few know how to love him by whom they were struck. This cuts. We can grit and bear it. We can do what Christ calls us to do, but he is calling us to something even higher, to love our enemies, to love them. He said, you have heard it was said, verse 43, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. This is the first one of these sayings that actually has a non-biblical part of the saying. Love your neighbor, of course, is biblical. We see it in Leviticus 19, and also Jesus quotes it several times to say that it is the greatest commandment to love your God and love your neighbor. But what appears nowhere in Scripture is this added portion, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. That's nowhere in the Bible. In fact, several places in the Old Testament Torah, the law of God, the first five books of the Bible, it says there shall not be two laws, one for you and one for the sojourner. You shall, if you have a sojourner living among you, provide for him as you would provide for yourself. There's so many things in the Torah that say that not only for our brothers, not only for our kinsmen, not only for our compatriots, but also for the foreigner, for the sojourner, for the poor. This added injunction that we hate our enemies is so far from the biblical ethic, and yet it was what was being taught to them by the scribes and the Pharisees. As we analyze this fake commandment to love your brothers and hate your enemies, don't we see exactly what people are doing today in our culture? That we take care of those who are like us. We take care of our kin and our families and those who agree with us, either politically or religiously. But those who do not, we have an iron fist. We see this all around us. But this is not the way of Christ. The highest law is to love your enemies, Jesus says. Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Your prayer might be Psalm 7. We read Psalm 7 today. I picked that. Lord, have vengeance on my enemies. Lord, protect me. And the Lord answers in that psalm, the Lord has indignation every day. The Lord does answer. We must trust God to have vengeance. We must trust the given authorities to carry out God's retribution. But we are to love our enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be sons of the Father who is in heaven. This is the highest law, to love our enemies. Not just to put up with them, but to love them. Indeed, this is what Christ did. The verse from camp last week comes from the Gospel of John. There is no greater love than this, than to lay down your life for your friend. As Paul says in Romans, that while we were enemies, Christ died for us. Christ did this very thing. When we were his enemies, he loved us and gave his life for us to redeem us. And we are called to do the same, to love our enemies and not to hate them. Again, as we circle back to the Sermon on the Mount once again, Jesus' articulation of the law reminds us of the use of the law. There are two uses, and there's two things being employed in the Sermon on the Mount and in the passages I read today. The first use of the law is to convict us of our sin. It is to show us that we have no ability to do what God is commanding. And indeed, we probably feel this today. We do not have the ability to carry this out. And as we continue on in the Sermon on the Mount, especially chapter 5, as we come back to it next week for the command not to commit adultery, which we'll all look forward to that sermon. But as we look at it, we find that we cannot possibly do it. In fact, there are interpretations of the Sermon on the Mount that it has no practical value either to individuals or communities because it is a dream which could never come true. But that's not true. The first use of the law is to convict us of our sin. It is to show us our need for God's grace. It is to point to the fact that Christ obeyed this perfectly when we could not, that he paid the penalty for us. But in our theology, we also have the third use of the law, which is that God's law serves as a guide for Christian living. This is how one theologian and writer, John Stott, maybe some of you have heard of John Stott, said it. He said, to put this beyond anybody's reach is to ignore the purpose of Christ's sermon. To put Christ's teachings within everybody's reach is to ignore the reality of man's sin. The purpose of the Sermon on the Mount is to show us that we can't do it, so that we rely on the grace of God. But the purpose of the Sermon on the Mount is to show us how a redeemed person should live. Paul says we are justified by faith alone. And James says that the faith that justifies is not alone. In other words, a person who is justified by faith will live and reflect what Jesus teaches in this sermon and what I've been talking about today. The title of the sermon is Vendetta. And maybe Rachel knows what I'm about to say, but one of our favorite lines from Bart Simpson, the Simpsons, is when, I don't remember the exact details of this, but there's an Italian boy, he's from Sicily or something, and he's in Springfield for some odd reason that Conan O'Brien or somebody cooked up. But anyway, there's an Italian boy, and Bart Simpson does something to him, and so this Italian boy has a vendetta, and he goes around saying, "Bart Simpson, vendetta, vendetta, Bart Simpson." Of course, this is a humorous homage to a lot of the gangster movies, especially The Godfather. You've heard me talk about The Godfather trilogy before, but The Godfather is a morality play. It illustrates the depths of loss and evil that happen when you don't do what Jesus is teaching. The Godfather is full of retaliation. It's, I'm going to retaliate for this, and I'm going to retaliate for this, and I'm going to retaliate for your retaliation, and your retaliation I'm retaliating for, and it goes over and over through the centuries until finally the very last scene of the third movie, spoiler alert, Michael Corleone, the Godfather, sits all alone with all of his friends, all of his colleagues dead, and even his own daughter murdered on the steps of a church in Rome. His wife divorced him. He is utterly alone. The result of the law of the tooth, the result of retaliation. Indeed, Rachel and I have experienced this personally. We used to live in the city of St. Louis. The city of St. Louis is one of the most dangerous cities in the country, with almost a murder per day. Here in Ithaca, we average about a murder per year. And the reason why there's a murder per day in St. Louis is because of retaliation. Because of a group of people who have over the history of our nation been oppressed and shut out from opportunity, who don't trust the police, and so they take justice for themselves. They engage in street justice. And so if someone gets me, I'm going to get them back. If someone murders my friend, we're going to murder his friend. A lot of this is bound up in gang activity, but it's not also. The result of this retaliation going over and over and over through the years in St. Louis is that as we lived and ministered in that part of the city, the north part of the city where most of this takes place, we talked with people and met people and were friends with people and understood that most of the folks who live there and are from there, there's nobody who was untouched from gun violence. Everybody knows someone, has a relative, has a son or a daughter that has been shot or has been murdered and is destroying the city. Retaliation destroys. One time I was in the hospital for appendicitis. That's a story we'll leave for later. This is a good story. But I was in the hospital for about 2 weeks because my appendix ruptured. I had no roommate for a few days, but one night I was awakened by a bunch of noise and they brought this guy in. He'd been shot. And we talked to each other over the days as you do when you're roommates. But one of the interesting things, I guess you would say interesting, is I would hear him as he talked to his friends on the phone and how they were planning to murder the guy who shot him as soon as he got out of the hospital. Friends, this is not only refer, retaliation does not only refer to physical violence, it also refers to emotional violence. It refers to verbal violence, psychological violence. The same effect happens if we continually retaliate and attack and respond with evil with evil. We will tear each other apart. And that's what's going on in our culture and in our church. We must reset our ways to the way of Christ. It is destroying us. Somebody has to be the one who stops the cycle, who says, I'm not going to retaliate, I'm not going to answer back, I'm going to stop the cycle of abuse, I'm going to get help, whatever that means. Somebody has to do that. A lot of people have to do that. And as Mahatma Gandhi found out, tried, and Martin Luther King Jr. actually brought about in this country, nonviolence and non-retaliation actually has power. Who'd have thunk it? The commands of Christ do have power. And as we engage in this new way of living, it will bear fruit in our lives and in the lives of our church, in the lives of our community. Let's pray.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. Please rate and review us on your podcast service and share with anyone who may be interested. The intro and outro music for the New Life podcast is provided by Sandra McCracken with her permission. Please visit her website at sandramccracken.com. We'll see you next week.